Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier podcast. I'm Dan Harris. My guest on this episode presents an intriguing mix. Some might say, and we'll hear what he has to say about this. He may disagree with this, but some might say he's a study in contradictions. On the one hand, he's been formally recognized as the reincarnation of not one but two Tibetan masters. On the other hand, he's thoroughly steeped in science. In fact, he's worked with scientists to design research to see what kind of impact meditation has on the brain. In one study, he and other experienced practitioners had their brain activity measured while meditating on compassion, and the neural activity in a key center of the brain associated with happiness increased by 700 to 800%. Researchers said they'd never seen anything like this before. Interestingly, notwithstanding his apparent mental fitness right now, my guest freely admits that as a kid, he suffered from anxiety and panic attacks, something I can relate to. His full name, he tells me we don't have to use the full name, but his full name is Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche. That last word, Rinpoche, is a Tibetan title conferred upon people viewed as meditation masters. It's sometimes described as being roughly akin to a PhD. He's the author of The Joy of Living, Unlocking the Secret and Science of Happiness. Rinpoche, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Was everything I just said reasonably accurate?
Perfect.
Perfect.
My name, you pronounce my name very well.
I've been practicing all morning. It's such a pleasure to meet you. We have, as we were discussing before we started recording, we have mutual friends.
Yes.
People who I really, really respect. Including the really eminent scientist, Richie Davidson, who was a student of yours and really encouraged me to look into your work and to meet you. So it's a pleasure to meet you in person.
Thank you. Pleasure to meet you, too.
There's so many things I want to ask you, but in your book, you say as a child, quote, anxiety accompanied me like a shadow.
Yeah.
So what was going on for you?
Yeah, actually, I was born in the northern part of Nepal, right middle of Himalaya mountain. So I have very nice environment, mountain, and my family is very, very loving and kind. But I don't know why I have this panic attack. So it's following me as like shadow. So I was looking for a lot of solution, and I play with my friend children's. Try to, you know, when you were a child, we make sand castle, mm-hmm. some kind of small house. I know how to make bow and arrow, you know, mm-hmm. when I was young. And basically fear about the snowstorm.
That was your fear, snowstorm?
Yeah, snowstorm and firework. And I cannot go into the car. As soon as I'm getting near the car, I feel nervous, you know. And sometime when I wake up, my heart is jumping and sweating. I don't know why I have this panic.
First thing in the morning.
Just wake up and feel like my heart is boiling, you know.
How little were you when this was happening?
Around 8 to 9, somewhere 8 to 9 years old. So then my father was a great meditator, and my grandma, grandpa, they all meditate. So when I look at them, they feel so calm, peaceful, just like a mountain. So I thought, I want to learn meditation from my father when I was 9 years old. But then I thought, I'm too young. Maybe I'm stupid. My father don't want to teach me. And I asked my mom, you know, what do you think? Should I ask my father to teach me meditation or not? And my mom said, very happy. Yes, great. But then I told my mom, please wait until my last decision, the final decision, don't ask my father. But she already asked my father. And my father asked me, do you want to learn meditation? I said, yes, of course, but who told you? And he said, my mom already told him. So then I tried to learn meditation from my father, and my father told me that don't look the peace in the external reality.
Don't look for peace in external reality?
Yeah. Don't look for peace in the external reality. The lasting happiness is within us. So that was a really, really benefit. And from there, I tried to learn meditation. But I like the idea of meditation, but I don't like the practice of meditation.
Well, a lot of people feel that way.
I feel like I'm very lazy. And when I meditate, it's okay for a few seconds, a few minutes. But then my panic comes back again. Then I give up. So I was struggling for 5 years. Then when I was 13, I was in northern India, a place called Shirabling Monastery, very big monastery. And there's one of my important guru, Thaisit Rinpoche, my teacher.
Thaisit Rinpoche. Can I just interrupt you for 1 second? Because
yes.
I don't think you're giving yourself enough credit here. Because at the age of, as I understand it, at the age of 13,
yes,
you went on a three-year meditation retreat.
Yeah. That was the, there's a traditional three-year retreat going to start there in Shirabling Monastery.
Shirabling Monastery. Yes.
It's near Dharamsala, you know?
That's where the Dalai Lama lives.
Dalai Lama residential from there, 2 hours by car. It's just near. And then I thought maybe I should join the traditional three-year retreat, solitary retreat.
At this point, you're still having panic attacks.
Still I have panic attacks. Since I've been meditating 9 years old, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 for 5 years.
So it wasn't a quick fix. It wasn't like you started meditating and everything was fixed.
Yeah. No.
Why would your parents... I know that your father was a great meditation master.
Yes.
I've heard his name many times. Remind me...
Tulku Urgyen Rinpoche.
Yes.
Right.
I was reluctant to say it because I thought I would screw it up, and I did. But why would they say, okay, yeah, son, you can go on a three-year meditation retreat?
I asked. I mean, I thought maybe it's good for me because I'm lazy, you know. So I thought if I go to that three-year retreat, then my lazy will not be there. So then I really want to go. First, I asked my father to ask them, Thaisit Rinpoche, to give permission to go to three-year retreat, and he did. Then I went to retreat.
Was it unusual for a 13-year-old boy to be on a retreat?
Yeah, normally it's quite young. I mean, this is why I'm a little bit hesitate. I cannot ask to Thaisit Rinpoche directly because I'm, again, too young. So I approach my father to ask Thaisit Rinpoche.
To ask Thaisit Rinpoche, the guy who runs Shirabling, the monastery.
Yeah,
but were you, I fear that this is a very Tibetan thing, you're being modest here. You must have shown some proficiency as a meditator in order for your father to recommend you to this eminent...
Yeah, they all say I'm meditating good, or since you're a child, you've been meditating. It's so nice, you understand very well. But I thought, they are maybe, you know, pleasing me. Maybe I'm not so perfect, and still I am panic, you know.
Were they concerned about your panic attacks, or did they think... that was normal.
Now, my father said, it's okay, you can go to retreat. And they're worried about my panic, of course. They both my father and mother, they're all concerned about my panic.
But they didn't think that you having panic attacks was a sign that you weren't a good meditator.
No. I mean, I'm practicing meditation. And, you know, when we learn meditation, what we call is experiential lineage. So we have to report every time, and then once you get experience, then I get next teaching. So therefore, my father said, I'm doing very well.
So I'm just going to elaborate on that because some of our listeners don't know much about meditation reports.
Yes.
So when you say it's an experiential lineage,
it,
meaning that in the lineage in which you were learning how to meditate, the tradition is to give a report of your experience to your teacher on a regular basis. So you would tell your teacher, in this case your father, about how your meditation was going, and it sounded like you were doing really well, even though you were having panic attacks.
Yes.
So he said, okay, go on the three-year meditation retreat.
Yeah.
And when you went off on this retreat, could you see your family during this time, or were you off?
Cannot see. My brother sometimes come to meet me once in a while. Otherwise, is it kind of like... a compound where there's two doors, one is front, one is side, and we cannot go out of that door. But we have small garden in front here, and each one individual room, we have group prayer hall, so sometimes we pray together. There are 18 of us. So
Wow, 18 people, 3 years,
yes.
And you're in this compound.
Yeah.
That's intense.
Very tense, very tense. And we need to wake up very early morning.
You wake up early in the morning?
Yes.
So how did it go for you? You're 13, you're still having panic attacks, you're...
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind to wake up early morning, I don't mind to do all these things, but my panic is sometimes comes. Sometimes we have group prayer, we pray together in the hall, and sometimes we use music instrument, you know, sometimes in Tibetan prayer, could be very loud. We have the cymbals and drum, bang, and so many, you know. Sometimes I cannot continue, so when I have panic, I have to leave the prayer, so it's very serious. So the main thing is that my lazy still follow me, even in the retreat. I thought, you know, I can escape from the lazy. But the worst, my lazy and my panic, they too become friends.
Oh, really? They became friends?
No, they become friends, yeah. So then what happened is I thought, okay, now I really going to accept my panic. Because until then, what I thought is I'm going to get rid of my panic. So there's two things. Resist, which is fear of panic, what I call panic of panic. Sometime I have the believe in my panic. You know, I listen. So what I call yes, sir, and hey, get out.
Mm.
So these two things. It's just like when you drive the car, you have gas and brake, right? So without gas and brake, you cannot drive car. So the main trigger or main the cause for panic for me is try to get rid of panic, or sometimes I listen to panic. So then what I did is, of course, I received a lot of teaching from my father and other teachers, which is making friends with the panic. So first, I accept my panic. Okay, I'm going to learn how to live with my panic. I'm going to face with my panic. So then I used my panic as support for my meditation. So normally the meditation is your mind be aware of your breathing and then visual object, sound, smell, taste, sensation. Then you can be aware of thought and emotion. But you need to practice step by step. At the beginning, you cannot watch panic. So if you be aware of panic, become overwhelmed. But if you have some experience before, in the end, you can use panic as support for meditation. Meditation.
It's another thing to be aware of.
Yeah, just like your breath. So then when you see the panic, what we call, if you see the river, that means you are out of river.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So if you fall into river, carried by river, you cannot see it. If you see, that means there's space between you and panic. You're free. So then I really apply that for intensively for 3 days, stay in my room alone, not join group prayer. Then after that, I have breakthrough. My panic really become my friend. But once panic become my friend, panic is gone, you know. Panic doesn't have good heart, so it's gone.
Really? So you're making me realize how far I have to go, because I have panic disorder, and it's definitely not my friend. And, you know, I've been meditating, I don't know, 7 years, but we come from very different cultures, and I didn't start when I was 9. And I can be aware of my breath, I can be aware of sights and sounds, but panic is too much.
Yeah.
And
So normally what we call this first step with the panic. First, you watch, but sometimes cannot. It's overwhelmed. So then you don't watch. So try something different. Meaning, don't watch panic, but create another emotion. When I was young, I create anger. So anger is kind of different than panic. So I use anger as support for my meditation. Be aware of anger. So then it's okay, then become successful, feel happy. Mm-hmm. So then slowly, I came to watch the panic. So even that doesn't work sometimes.
So let me interrupt you. So yes. You're saying, so you would feel panic come on, and you would say, all right, I can't be with the panic,
yes.
So I will bring up anger.
Yeah.
But I can be with that.
Yeah.
So if I'm... I have to go get an MRI. Do you know what an MRI? Yes, you do, because you've been in an MRI machine.
Yes.
So I have to go get an MRI. That creates a lot of panic for me. So you were saying, when I get in the MRI machine and I start to feel panic, bring up anger and pay attention to that instead.
Yeah. Pay attention to that. So bring up anger and be aware of anger. So once you do that, you build up some kind of habit of practice with the negative emotion, what we call like strong emotion. So then slowly, slowly you can aware of panic a little bit. 3 seconds, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Boom, panic come back, same as normal. Okay, let it go. And another way is you change your focus. Maybe when you have panic, your mind focus on your breath. You focus on anger or you focus on breath. Sometimes focus on the sound. When you feel panic, focus on sound. Panic, sound. Panic, sound. So these two things, what we call, try something different. So by doing that, then you build up the, what we call, like power of the awareness. The mind, the focus, the meditation become more and more clear for you. Then eventually you can aware. But sometimes, even you do that, doesn't work. Then what we call, step back. Step back meaning, look at behind the panic. So maybe panic or panic, resistant, aversion, and don't like the panic. These things sometimes more stronger than panic. So don't watch panic. Watch the emotion behind the emotion. Try to see. This is what we call step back. And sometimes that doesn't work. What do? Take a break. maybe walk, read a boring book or whatever book. Do some physical exercise, and you come back in. Try a little bit meditation.
After the break, did you have times when you didn't have any food? Or
of course, of course. The first month, I almost died.
You almost died? After this.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction.
There's a new answer for people in need of serious pain relief. Lidocare has created a one-of-a-kind pain relief patch that blocks pain for up to 8 hours. With the only non-water-based lidocaine patch on the market, Lidocare uses patent-pending technology to desensitize aggravated nerves for an odor-free, ultra-flexible, dry, and light solution to pain. The Lidocare Pain Patch from the makers of Blue Emu. For long-lasting relief you can wear. Available at CVS.
So you had a breakthrough and you felt like the panic went away, but you stayed on retreat and you, as I understand it, you kept doing more of these long retreats.
Yeah. So I did finish the 3 year and 3 months, what we call that's finished, complete finish. And after that, I want to do more retreat. And my father said, maybe do some study. So I did traditional Buddhist study for what we call philosophy study, yes.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you decide that you were going to become a teacher?
Just finished my retreat. My retreat teacher, very important. He is 84 years old. He passed away Salji Rinpoche, another Tibetan name.
What is his name again?
Salji Rinpoche.
Salji Rinpoche.
Yeah. He's my retreat teacher. Mm-hmm. Very, very nice. He's a very great meditator. So he passed away. So then head of our monastery, Daisid Rinpoche, recommended me to do next 3-year retreat teacher.
At age 16?
At 17.
17?
Yeah. End so of 17.
You ran the next retreat?
Yeah, I did.
So you must have been viewed as a prodigy.
I don't know. I told Daisid Rinpoche, maybe I'm too young. I don't have good experience. What do you think? He said, I know you can do it. So then I accepted.
And what did the other monks think? Did they think, well, who's this kid?
They're happy, but in my retreat, all those, I think 19 of them, and all of them from above 25 to 60 years old.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, child and teaching to the parents. But they're all quite happy. Although that time I don't have too much things to say, like just follow whatever in the text, whatever they have special instruction, I just follow that. That's quite okay for me. But then end of that year, I'm already joined the philosophy school.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm learning so many new things. The second year, then I become more confident and more experienced. I can teach more. So they're all very happy and they all kind of respect. So no one complain.
It's pretty amazing. It's really amazing. And I don't think, I worry that our listeners won't really understand how amazing this is because you are, and I said this earlier, this is a very Tibetan thing.
Yeah.
Very modest. And if you talk to the Dalai Lama and say, hey, are you a good meditator? He'll say, no, I'm a terrible meditator. It's just right. The way, in your culture, modesty is a big deal.
Right.
But so I will say it so you don't have to. But you really were viewed as a prodigy, and it is extremely rare for a 17-year-old kid to be running a retreat of this nature with – these were advanced meditators in the retreat, mm-hmm. and you were their teacher. So, and you went on to – obviously, you're sitting here. How old are you now?
40.
40.
Yeah.
You look like you're 20.
Oh, thank you very much. You make me so happy.
and you've been teaching for all of these years and also doing long retreats on your own. And I know that you actually recently finished a long retreat, which I want to talk to you about. But first, let's talk a little bit about science.
Yes.
Because in between doing long retreats and teaching long retreats, you got interested in science. How did that happen and where and when did it happen?
Yeah. So when I was young, around 9 years old, there's some good scientists. Like one of my friend is called Francesco Varela.
He's an eminent neuroscientist. Yes.
He came to Nepal to learn meditation from my father. So back then, I'm kind of naturally interested in science. And that time, I'm interested more about stars, galaxies, how far they are, how big they are. And there's a lot of new findings about the atom, subatomic particle, proton, neutron, all these things, you know. So I asked him about physics. And he told me something a little bit about these galaxies. And also he told me a little bit about the brain. So one thing I still remember is he told me the brain can sense and feel everything. But brain itself doesn't have sensation. So if you want to do operation on your brain, no need anesthesia. So I was thinking, wow. So, and then I did 3-year retreat, I told you. And after that, I'm joined a traditional college, Buddhist college. So which is morning you have to listen, then you have to contemplate. And then in the evening, you have to debate, you know, like clapping the hand like this and debate in loud voice. And you can debate about everything. So this is very similar as modern science. You know, in the debate, you can debate about everything. And the real meaning about the debate is to see the nature of reality. And the modern science also see the nature of reality. What Buddha said, don't take my words, just that I say so, you have to examine, contemplate, and meditate. Then you can take it.
That's why I like the Buddha, because right. I'm not a big fan of being told to take things on faith.
Yeah, yeah. So therefore, it's kind of like basic nature in Tibetan Buddhism. We are really interested about explore, and so then there's a lot of stuff in modern science. When I was that was in 1998, I first came to USA. So I was teaching meditation that time, and I at the same time I want to meet some scientists. If there's any scientists who came to my talk, I try to make conversation with them and talk. And then they all give me a lot of tapes. In that time, there's a big, you know, no DVD, no what.
VHS tapes.
Yeah, very big one. Big books. And when I got back to India, I have one pile of those tapes. And I went to, I brought all this into my monastery, and then I watched there also in the monastery, try to understand. So then 2003, I came to, and we have Mind and Life meeting, you know?
Mind and Life Institute, which is, let me just explain to people, Mind and Life Institute was founded in part with the Dalai Lama.
Yes.
And the goal was to use modern scientific techniques to look at what contemplative practices, meditation, et cetera, yes. does to the brain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, so I joined time to time that meeting. And from that meeting, I came to, I decided to be guinea pig.
A guinea pig.
Yes. In 2003, I went to Wisconsin with Dr. Richard Davidson.
Dr. Richard Davidson, who is going to be on the podcast soon, and he was actually on our first podcast. The first podcast we did was with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Richie Davidson at the University of Wisconsin. And Richie didn't get to talk much because I focused most of my questions on the Dalai Lama. But Richie's a friend of mine, and Richie is really been the guy at the forefront of investigating what meditation does to the brain. Yes. And in one of his, and I talked about it a little bit in the introduction, one of his seminal studies was taking a bunch of really experienced meditators, yourself included, and looking and you know, putting electrodes on your head while you meditated and putting you inside of MRI tubes while you meditated.
Yes.
And the results were really, really interesting.
Yes, yes. So since 2003, I've been there. And I became guinea pig. At the same time, we did a lot of kind of like discussion, and I asked Richie about the brain, all this perception, all this stuff. So I learned a lot. So therefore, I'm really deeply interested in the science.
And what do you think? What is the importance to you of the mix of science and contemplative practice? Why is this so? What's the value in your view?
Yeah, for me, there are many parallels between science and the view of Buddhist philosophy. For example, about the atom, about the perception, about how our mind works, like brain and all these things. So, but we are talking like using different language, different metaphor, different aspect. So in Buddhism, we investigate. It's kind of like thought experiment. So we do debate, we contemplate, and then we meditate. Then we can get some experience. The experience is kind of like result of the test, kind of a laboratory. By doing all this, contemplate, receive teaching, contemplate, debate, and meditation, then we got some experience. So then we go to the more further, deeper level. But in modern science, you have many computer nowadays, right? So you can do things, a lot of things in the computer. And then a lot of finding is very similar as we are talking about in Buddhism. So therefore, it's kind of fascinating. And for me, it's kind of like so happy to see these things, even though we are talking same thing. But no, we are talking same thing, but different terms. And what Dalai Lama said, like modern science is like intelligent brain, and the Buddhist meditation is kind of like more warm heart.
Mm-hmm.
So intelligent brain and warm heart together, then also we can maybe help for the society, for the bigger society and for the world.
Because if you can prove the benefits of meditation to the brain,
yes,
and to other parts of the body, then maybe the rest of the world will adopt these practices.
Yeah, and yeah, in science, there's a lot of findings, but they may not have the method. For example, you can find about the mind, what we call monkey mind, perception, the restless mind, what the emotion comes, but there's no so much practice how to deal with that. So in Buddhist meditation, we have a lot of things about that. And therefore, now I'm making kind of like special course in Buddhism. We have many ancient meditation techniques, which is want to make available for everybody. So you don't have to become Buddhist. And these techniques can practice everybody, and no need particular belief, no need particular belief in Buddha or any other religion. So therefore, now I'm trying to focus on this teaching, what I call joy of living. So I wrote book Joy of Living.
Yes.
And connected with that, there's Joy of Living workshops. So level one, level two, level three, all these three levels, all these are connected with the awareness, level one, love and compassion, level two, the wisdom, level three, yes.
So I'm interested. I said at the beginning that you are in some ways a study in contrast because you are so deeply involved in science, and yet, and maybe you don't see these things as a contrast, so mm-hmm. I'd like to hear you out on this. And yet, you are part of a tradition where reincarnation is a big part of the tradition, and yes. You are have been officially identified as the reincarnation of two previous meditation masters. So, where is the evidence for that? How does that align with your allegiance with science?
Yeah, I have two brains actually. So some of the one brain say I want to eat pizza and another brain say I have coffee and I'm fighting in between. I'm just kidding. So, I mean, reincarnation, what we believe, like, we all have this enlightened nature. So in Buddhism, what we believe is basic innate goodness. So everybody has basic innate goodness and the nature of everybody is good and is pure, and it is awesome. So in another way, everybody is kind of like reincarnated. Everybody is the precious person. So, but me recognize as kind of reincarnated, and I don't have so much kind of like thinking about those things, and it's not so important that whether I recognize or not. What I like is I like to practice Buddhism meditation, and this really helped me. For example, like my panic is kind of like changed my life and also saved my life. So therefore, all these things are very important. The Buddha said, don't worry too much about past and future, past life, future life, whatever. So this life is very important, the future, present life. So if you go into the forest and if you shot by poison arrow, first thing what you have to do is take out the poison arrow. Don't look for where's this poison arrow come from, who shot me. So if you look around, don't take care of poison arrow now, you will die. So that's what Buddha suggests, you know. Yes.
So are you saying that this is part of your culture? You don't know whether it's literally true, but it's a nice tradition or
yeah, it's a nice tradition. I mean, it's not like I'm against of that. I mean, I'm happy and kind of like balance. What we call mind, don't be too tight. Have to need a proof, scientific proof. So we may not have that, scientific proof. But when we do meditation, of course, there's a lot of good experience by doing meditation. I have some kind of like, how to say, practice, which is related with my previous Minjiru Rinpoche practice or whatever they do. If I do that, I am more beneficial. I feel like really helping me. All these connections there. And then plus that, normally we don't talk too much about like, I know my past life, I know my future life, or I have special quality, power, clairvoyance. These are not so important. So we don't talk too much about those things.
you said something there that could have slipped by, so I just want to get into it in just a second, because you said that when you do practices associated with previous Mingyur Rinpoches, that you feel...
More connection.
You do feel a connection to these. And so you, I guess in some ways you have this, a feeling that maybe this is true?
Yeah, right. You're right.
No proof, but a feeling.
Yeah. So, yes.
There's a... I sometimes argue with my meditation teacher. Yes. You may have met him. Is a guy named Joseph Goldstein?
Yeah.
Okay, so Joseph is my meditation teacher. And
from
IMS.
Yes, I met him many times.
Oh, yeah, you've been to the Insight Meditation Society up at yes. So we sometimes have debates about metaphysical issues.
Yes.
And I make fun of him for believing in things that he can't prove. And he tells me that the right attitude is to have a mind of not knowing.
Right.
And just saying, okay, so I don't know, but I'm not shutting it down and I'm not saying it's true. It's a it's a balance between the two.
True. That's true. That's very important. So some people said, we don't want to believe against. Some said, we have to believe. But the Buddha said balance. So whatever you say, that's important. And another thing is, as you said, in Tibetan tradition, even you ask, even they know, they will never tell about whatever your experience, past life, even their memory, past life, normally it's not allowed to tell.
You mean, so if you had memories of your past lives, you wouldn't be able
even
to tell
I have,
me?
I will not tell you. Of course, I don't have, but even I have, I will not tell you.
Why not?
This is kind of like, kind of commitment. Commitment, what we call
commitment,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, for example, when we meditate, they might have many different experiences. Maybe you might have special experience, but if you tell to others, it becomes showing off. It may become cause of ego, may become cause of selfish. So it could be danger. Danger for the ego.
I see.
So therefore, we have to modify? Yeah, moderate.
Oh, moderate, yes.
Yeah, have to be humble. It's very important.
But do you discuss it with your fellow monks?
Yeah, we can discuss it with our teacher and with the fellow, what we call, spiritual brother and sister who receive same teaching, practice same thing, we can share among us.
Well, I'm glad you brought this up because one of, I will admit that I've said this before, so I will admit I have a little bit of a bad attitude about many things, but in particular, a little bit of a wariness around Tibetan Buddhism because it does involve a lot of metaphysical stuff that, you know, so does, I mean, I practice Theravadan Buddhism, which there's plenty of metaphysical stuff in Theravadan Buddhism too. Right. But generally speaking, it's easier to kind of strip away. There's no robes. There's, at least as it's practiced in the West, you know, Joseph is just like a normal 70-year-old Jewish guy. But Richie Davidson, our friend, has tried to, and other friends of mine have said that, I'm missing out. That by my closed-minded attitude is blinding me to things of real value potentially for me. But one of the issues I have is that there is there's this whole tradition in Tibetan and practice of, you know, tantra, these sort of secret rituals that you don't discuss with, you know, civilians like regular people like me. So that makes me a little suspicious. Why is that all because of the ego concern you were raising
mainly
before?
Mainly the ego concern. So in the past, there are some, when you meditate, sometimes there's something experience comes. You know people's mind and you have some special capability. So if you do that, then in the end, you become bad person. I mean, it's become like what we call a Mara. Mara meaning evil.
Yeah.
So evil might have possessed those things. So, but without having kind, compassion, humbleness, all this, then these things useless, right? So sometimes people, they think, oh, if you meditate, you can fly. Fly is not so important. Nowadays, everybody can fly, right? So I flew from India to here with more than 300 people.
What is the role of prayer in Tibet? Why is prayer important and who are you praying to?
So the prayer, what we call the body, speech, mind, the speech, to pray. So the word has special power. Once you put into the word, then many things come together. And then, for example, if you write something, in order to write, you have to first think, and then you have to ask your body to come up that whatever the word you are saying, and that's image, there's a visualize, I mean, the imagination, there's the motivation, there's the body movement, and they influence all your body. So it's a kind of like that if you praise something, and we believe that it has some kind of positive, if you pray good thing, then there's positive interdependent connection. Just like maybe the butterfly in USA may cause a huge earthquake in Japan?
Yes, or a hurricane.
Similarly,
yeah, yes, yeah.
Interdependent. Yes.
But so are you praying to a deity or are you praying to...
You can pray to Buddha. You can pray for other sentient beings. Two things. One, you need to pray like deity or Buddha. One, no need to pray to deity. One, just pray for other sentient beings. And third aspect, which is you pray for... You pray with your true nature. Your nature, Buddha nature. So you don't need a particular deity. You don't need a particular high supreme being, which is which fulfill your meaning of prayer. Just connect with your true nature. Yes.
What is the role of women in Tibetan practice?
The women in Tibetan Buddhist, what we call, there's a wisdom and method. So the woman is the wisdom aspect. The male is the method aspect. And these two are like two wings of birth. For example, shamatha is the male aspect. Vipassana is female aspect.
Shamatha is often translated as concentration, meditation.
Yes.
Vipassana is insight or wisdom meditation. But does that mean, because you don't see a lot of female teachers in the Tibetan tradition.
Yeah, there's, in Tibet we have Tibetan Triyana. So Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana. But the Tibetan Triyana, Hinayana, many people they say similar as Theravada, but not similar. Some is similar, some not similar. But in Tibetan Hinayana, we have both, but men focus for the male aspect. Mahayana, both equal. Vajrayana, female quality, more aspect. So therefore, there's some kind of like general culture dominated by Hinayana. So there's a lot of like Vinaya and then ancient culture before the Dharma came to Tibet is the male dominant. So therefore, there's a lot of male dominant. But now... And also, 800 years back, there's so many female teachers in Tibet also. A lot of nunnery, big nunnery. And then after some time, it's become, like, quiet. So now we all try to rebuild.
So there's a focus on rebuilding the role of women in the teaching infrastructure?
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about the joy of living. Is it an institute or what's the name? You teach
my
in the West. Yeah.
Terigar.
Terigar.
Yeah, Terigar.
And
Terigar.
And so if people want to learn from you, they can look up.
Terigar.org.
Terigar.org.
Yes.
And can you give me a sense of what the practices are? Because we've been talking about sort of. What I would call deep end of the pool prayer and reincarnation, but a lot of what you teach is actually quite down to earth.
Yeah. So what I teach there in Terigar, we have two main programs. One is Joy of Living workshops. Second is Path of Liberation workshops.
Path of Liberation.
Yeah. Path of Liberation is more connected with the Buddhist. And Joy of Living is for secular basis. So the first one is calming the mind. So bringing your mind or recognizing your mind, your own awareness. So what we believe is everybody has basic innate goodness. So all these qualities are within us all the time. So normally, sometime when I give teaching, I ask to the audience, how many of you think that you have awareness? So half of audience raise hand. And the other half say, I don't have awareness. The And I'm telling that is the sign of awareness. Because if you raise your hand, of course, you're aware that you have awareness. And those who said, I don't have awareness, you're aware that you don't have awareness, right? So awareness with us all the time. But the problem is we don't recognize normally. We don't recognize our own awareness. So the joy living level one is introduce awareness and then practice. Nurture your own awareness, connect it with your awareness. Then eventually, like you can be aware of form, sound, smell, taste, sensation, 5 sensory objects. So everything becomes support for awareness. And slowly, thought and emotion. So mainly joy living is kind of like you live your life joyful with under any circumstances, under any situation. So you can meditate everywhere, anytime, even 2 or 3 seconds while you're talking, while you're walking at your office, doing exercise. So that's the main thing about the joy of living. So what we call finding happiness, finding joy everywhere and anytime. Yeah. And level 2 is opening heart. So it's about love and compassion. Again, we all have love and compassion. So we want to be happy, don't want to suffer, right? All of us. Every minute, every breath, every movement, every eyes blink, is looking for happiness. Mm-hmm. And that is actually love. The essence of love is want to be happy, want to be good, want to see good, but maybe you might not know the real causes of the happiness. So, but actually, the love is there and want to free from sufferings, compassion. So I try to introduce again, which is you already possess. And from there, then practice, nurture your own love and compassion and expand to all living beings. So that's the level 2. And level 3 is the wisdom. So we all have innate wisdom. So deep of our heart, we know impermanent. We know interdependent, all these things, right? And even we know that our true nature is good, somehow, deep of heart. And we know that so many things about our life. So in the end, the real meaning of wisdom is go beyond of concept. So that's the level 3. So, but it doesn't mean beyond concept means you cannot feel things, you cannot, you cannot see what is good, what is bad, and you become completely like a zombie. It's not like that. So you, how to say, the unhealthy sense of self will liberate, but the healthy sense of self will manifest.
And do your students... Is your goal to bring them to enlightenment? And what do you think enlightenment even means?
For the joy of living, the goal is to have better human being, healthy human being, calm, kindness human being. So that's all. But there's not too much thinking about enlightenment or not. But if meaning of enlightenment is totally recognize your true nature. So Buddha said, what is the real meaning of enlightenment? Meaning you completely, fully recognize your true nature. It's nothing that you need to go to somewhere or you become like, you can fly or... not like that.
Do you know anybody who's totally recognized their true nature?
I mean, many people, they are practice, which is recognize nature of mind. So we have... Especially in path of liberation, we have special introduction about nature of mind. Many people recognize in the West. Also, of course, we do in the Tibetan tradition, some many people in the West, many people recognize nature of mind and feel very happy and they change their life. Even they change their personality also. So I've been seeing them many times. So happy to see and meet those people, yes.
What's the difference for you between the type of students you get in the West and the type of students you get in the East?
Normally what I call in the East, more follow with the faith.
Faith.
At the beginning, yes. Yeah. In the West, more follow with the wisdom. intellectual beginning. So why, how, what, when. But in the West, this one next, and this one you have to do like that. So more, how to say, in East, more kind of like package, I mean the delivery. In the West, more cooperate,
mm-hmm.
collaborate, kind of a process. Student and teacher try to see, yeah.
So the students here are probably more of a pain in the butt. They ask you difficult questions. They need you to explain things more. Yeah. They don't just take it on faith.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. More questions, which is I like.
You like
which,
it?
Yeah, which is we have to do in Buddhist in general. We have to ask any question and we have to debate about anything.
And so even though you're teaching all over the world, you still have a very active practice. As I understand it, you just finished a long retreat of your own?
Yeah.
How long?
4.5
4.5 years?
Yeah.
So you just stepped out of all of your teaching?
Yeah, I just leave from my monastery without having money and no plan and no friends and no nothing.
Wait, so you left your monastery?
Yeah.
With no money, no nothing.
Nothing. Only, at the beginning, only a few thousand rupees, maybe 5,000-6,000 rupees, Indian rupees, that's all.
And this is in Nepal?
India.
India, okay.
Yeah, in the midnight.
At midnight?
Yeah.
And a few thousand rupees, just, that's not, in India, that's not a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so, and for 4.5 years, you just lived?
Yeah, live without any plan, for food. Baking the food.
By yourself?
By myself, yeah. So what we call this traditional, another is wandering retreat. So I did before 3 year retreat is solitary retreat, right? This one is a wandering retreat. Wandering retreat meaning no particular money, no fixed plan, no shelter, no resident, and just go.
Did you have times when you didn't have any food or?
Of course. The first month I almost died.
You almost died?
Yeah, yeah. Because I just, I was naive, you know. Normally I'm like Dharma prince. So I have a lot of things, all this. I never stay on street even 1 hour before. But I have this idea in my mind, I want to do wandering retreat. So I just left. So then I went to my monastery and go to the train station nearby there. And from there, I bought the cheap train to another place, holy place called Varanasi. So I stay there on the street in the railway station for 3 days. So first, I feel very embarrassed. I don't mind. There's no perfect mattress, you know, no utility, no. But just feeling nervous. Then embarrassed. So then end up, I went to another holy place called Kushinagar, where Buddha passed away. The place where Buddha passed away, Paranirvana. So then after 3 weeks later, all my money is gone. So I have to completely stay on the street. And there's one kind of small restaurant. Normally I go there when I have money. I eat food from there. So then I went there and told them that, now all my money is finished, so can you give me leftover food? They said, okay, they will give me the leftover food. So you have to come in the night. So I went there every night and took the leftover food. And that food has maybe virus or food poison or something. I have diarrhea, vomiting for 3 days. No money for medicine. So I just drink water. There's a well water, you know, nearby. There's just like do this, tuk, tuk, like this, then water is coming. You have to run very fast. Otherwise, when you reach to the Oreo tip,
mm-hmm.
the water is already gone. So you have to back and forth.
And you were doing this while sick?
While sick, yeah. I'm doing that. After 3 days later, I thought maybe I'm going to die. So the day fourth, in the afternoon around 2-3 p.m., I have very nervous. I think I'm going to die. What should I do? Should I go back or stay? If I go back, just one phone call is okay. I can go back. So they may come and pick me up. So then in the end, I decided to stay. So prepare for dying. So then in the morning, around 2 a.m., I cannot move my body. So we have the dying meditation, what we call kind of like practice. So I'm doing the dying meditation, and then I cannot see my eyes, cannot hear, and then slowly my body become paralyzed. And I'm trying to rest my mind in the meditation, you know, what we call open awareness. You just rest your mind into the awareness itself. So awareness, it is free, always there, and rest. I feel like I'm falling and floating and so many things. In the end, I almost become unconscious. Almost, okay, now I'm losing my mind. Suddenly, wang. I say wang, but I cannot put into word. My mind completely open. It's like blue sky with sun shining without cloud. So clear, so vivid. And there's no, what we call normal monkey mind.
Mm-hmm.
The mind which is image, the verbal, all these things are gone. So almost like I know, but without thinking. And that experience, there's no time, no direction, no front, no back, completely open. And I was in that state maybe 5-6 hours. This continued. Am I die? No. And try to move my finger, cannot move. Just like sometimes when we have lucid dream and we try to move our body, we cannot move, right? Just like that. I thought my breath is stopped, but I don't know, maybe not, because I cannot really check. But I know my finger cannot move. Then in the end, I feel like this is not the time for me to die now. Some kind of that feeling comes. And that feeling becomes stronger, and that has some kind of sense of compassion. And suddenly I feel my body then. And slowly, I can move. I can hear the sound. Normally there's so many noise around, which is we cannot hear. So I hear so many things. And slowly I can look. Then I look around. So then, before that street was not so nice, you know. I don't want to stay there. It's not belong. I'm not belong here. So somehow I'm not really connect. But after that, wow, it's like my home. And the ground is so nice, and the trees around there, and there's leaves green shining, the branches, and so I feel like so gratitude and so much appreciation. Just can appreciate that I have these eyes and can see. I'm still breathing. And so body become very light, so happy. Then I want to drink the water because it feels thirsty. So I stand up and try to get the water, and I fell down, become unconscious. So I woke up in the hospital. Someone took me in the hospital, and they put this,
IV.
IV, yeah. And I woke up and I thought, where am I? So the person gave me some money also. They said, I will pay your bill. So that was nice. And I stayed at the hospital one night. And next day they said, come back again. But I didn't go back. Then from there, I went to the Himalaya mountains.
To the mountains?
Mountains, yeah. To the mountains.
And continued your retreat?
Yeah.
How did you, and you were just living in the mountains?
Yeah, from there, in summer, I go to the Himalaya mountains. Like Nepal, India, I go to different mountains. And in the mountains, people give support. Those, I'm Lama, you know, monk, Tibetan monk, who do retreat in the mountains. The most in the mountain, there are Buddhists, the local people. So they're very happy who do retreat in the cave. They give food. They sometimes, even I say no, they bring so many things. So in the mountain, nice. And during summer, I come down from mountain because in the mountain it's too cold. So I went to like Buddhist and Hindus holy places, like sadhu. I become sadhu.
A wandering mendicant, yes.
Something like that. So then I went to some different ashram, you know, Hindu ashram. So I can take some free food also. So I know where to get free food.
So 4.5 years, no contact. Did you have contact with your family? Did you?
No. I sent one letter from one of the retreat. So, but they cannot contact me. I just sent letter. I sent letter 2 times.
How did you decide that it was over?
I think the earthquake. There's big earthquake in Nepal.
Yeah.
So then I was a little bit concerned, and that makes me my little bit shorter.
It was going to be longer than 4.5 years?
Maybe, because it's not particular plan. Maybe 5 years, maybe 6 years, maybe 10 years. But then somehow 4.5 years, I come back.
What do you think the benefit of that retreat was for you?
There's two things, I think. One is I really want to develop my meditation, and what we call, if we develop certain experience, then if we face difficult challenge in our life, it's really good for meditation to develop. Another one is to learn about the life. So before, I'm like Dharma Prince, so I don't know much about life beyond my circle, right?
Mm.
So I learn a lot. So I'm now thinking that I'm become more human than before.
You met a lot of people.
Many people, different people. I have to learn how to cook, how to collect the wood, how to, I need to survive by myself, right? So many things I learned.
And after that experience you described earlier where you almost died,
right,
are you less afraid of death now?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that time, only 2 hours is very challenging. After that, I tried to accept, and now ready to die. But I'm not saying commit suicide, those things, you know. But what we call try to accept, and if it's natural death, it's okay.
If it's a natural death, it's okay.
Yeah. Natural death meaning I'm not forcing to die, but it comes spontaneously. Yes.
I have a whole long list of questions that I realize I'm now not going to be able to ask you because I know you need to get back to a lunch, so I'm going to be sensitive to your time.
Thank you.
Would you come back sometime?
Yeah. So, I will come.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was an enormous pleasure to sit here and to be able to speak to you for an hour. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm so happy that you have very great questions, and it's very happy and fun talking with you.
All right, there's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you like it, I'm going to hit you up for a favor. Please subscribe to it, review it, and rate it. I want to also thank the people who produced this podcast, Josh Cohan, Lauren Efron, Sarah Amos, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. And hit me up at Twitter, Dan B. Harris. See you next time. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than 2 centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the new Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.